Dear Nasties, before we start today's episode, we would like to tell you about an awesome platform and app called Castbox. Now, Castbox is an online platform that helps podcasters promote their shows to an audience of millions of people. But the cool thing for you as a listener, though, is that you can use Castbox as an app to listen to all of your podcasts for free. You can download it for free and you can listen to it for free. I'm also using it myself, and one thing I really like about it is that I get all kinds of cool suggestions based on the podcasts that I'm listening to, and I've really enjoyed those suggestions so far, so I really suggest you give Castbox a try. You can download it on Android and Apple, so go ahead, make the download. Now on to the show.
She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Okay, hello. Thanks for listening to the She Who Persisted podcast. I am Heather, and talking with me today is Jesse Cohen-Filippic. Thank you, Jesse, for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure.
Today we're going to be discussing a few different topics and how they intersect with one another. Specifically, how does being a member of the LGBT community, a mother, and an academic intersect? We asked our listeners to contact us if they were willing to share, which is how we thankfully came in contact with Jesse. So please keep an eye on our Facebook page for similar posts in the future, because we want to hear from you. We want to hear from our listeners. We want your stories, especially if they're stories that we have no personal experience with. We need to hear from you. So Jesse, again, thank you so much for your willingness to be a part of this interview.
Sure.
First question, how do you identify within the LGBT spectrum?
So I have always identified as a lesbian, and I have started to use the term queer more. I felt for a while too old for that, but I would say generally, yeah. I still identify as a lesbian.
Okay, so then, you know, what was the transition then to making you a little more comfortable with using the term queer?
So I came out in a time when people were still not using that term comfortably. So early 90s, and it was very much still perceived, certainly by everyone older than me, and I think my peer group, as being a slur. And as I have sort of grown into my own identity, and I spend most of my life around 18 to 23 year olds, it's just become a term that feels a little more feels more flexible and more all-encompassing, and I think people use it in different ways, so I wouldn't say that I've adopted it entirely as my own, but I will often use it rather than the ironically, after all, the term lesbian ends up seeming very kind of formal and stuffy.
Oh, right. Okay, well then, so when someone is referring to you, then if you were to have this discussion, which would you prefer to be called then?
I would say as a queer person, probably.
As a queer person, okay.
Yeah.
So then, as a queer individual, how have you, I guess, had support? You said you came out in the early 90s. Did you have support from friends and family then, were, you know, just using the term lesbian at the time? How did that go?
So I think a theme for me will be throughout this interview that I've actually had some areas where I've had incredible privilege. So I, for a little bit of context, I came out while attending a women's college as a first year student. So came out when I was 17, 18. And though I think my parents and family had a bit of a time adjusting to it, my parents had had gay friends. I had sort of grown up not in an area where there were lots of gay or queer people around, but I had incredible support from my friends, many of whom were struggling with the same issues as I came out. And then my family of origin was, like I said, it took a little bit of time to adjust, but was incredibly supportive. And sort of from that point on, I had a pretty small family, but I was out to all family. So I'd say in terms of my primary support system, I've been really fortunate.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Have you noticed if that has support or that support is like fluctuated at all during different life stages, particularly among friends then, since your family has seemed to be very supportive?
Right. I would say not from friends, because a lot of those friends are the same, but certainly right. In other social contexts. So in employment contexts, in kind of general social contexts, that has shifted some. Mm-hmm. And then a little bit around people, again, being very supportive, but trying to figure out what it means, particularly in my family. I am married to a woman, what it means to have two, I can't do my air quotes visibly, but two moms. I think that has actually been an interesting challenge to some of our family, and not friends probably, but just to some of our family.
Right. So where you currently reside, do you have a supportive public community where you currently live?
So it's an interesting thing. We live in a bubble. So we live in Ithaca, mm-hmm. New York, which is they describe it as 10 square miles surrounded by reality. So it's a very progressive little bubble. So certainly a supportive public community. That being said, I've lived here almost 5 years and we're not particularly connected to that community. There are trans people and gay people and queer people who live here, and there's certainly people we've encountered and know. And there's general public community support. It's a very safe place.
Right.
But we don't feel connected to the community at large, and we don't feel particularly connected to the LGBTQ community.
Okay. Have you felt that way in other places that you've lived?
I have. Ironically, I felt that way in some places where it wasn't as comfortable and as safe. So I spent a big chunk mm-hmm. of my life in Richmond, Virginia, a far less progressive place, but I actually felt more connected to the larger community. And then certainly places where I've lived with more of my friends nearby, and I've lived in cities where I've felt much more connected to the community. So this has been an interesting challenge. I think it probably overlaps with that academic piece and the parenting piece. Mm-hmm. Sure we'll talk about that a little bit more.
Oh, yeah. So as you mentioned, you're also a parent. How many children do you have and how old are they?
Sure. So the short answer is I have one four-year-old daughter. And the slightly longer answer is that my wife and I are foster parents. And so we mm-hmm. are still an open foster home. We don't have any other kids in the house right now, but we have a couple of young adults who spent a long time with us and are very much a part of our family. So I play a parental role. Those people have other parents, but we play very much a parental role in their lives. But in terms of kids that we have at home full-time right now, we have one four-year-old daughter.
Awesome. Four-year-olds are fun.
Mm-hmm. I've been told she's not four yet. She's almost four. And I've been told that tornado is the term to describe.
Yeah, we noticed that, we'd always heard about the terrible twos, but with ours, it was more of a three-nager,
yes.
I called it.
Yes, we with the attitude. That a lot. So we'll see what the 3-4 transition does.
So before bringing academia into this discussion completely, what's been the most challenging thing about being a parent? And what are some of the personal challenges that you feel are probably more prevalent as a queer parent?
So, and again, this overlaps with some other pieces. I guess I'll add that my daughter came to us in foster care as an infant and has since been adopted. So one of the things that was different for us was that we became parents. And in fact, before that, we'd had a number of other foster placements. We became parents in an instant. We literally had an hour's notice.
Oh, wow.
So that's a different experience than planning for parenthood. Obviously, we had talked about it and we had gone through the training. I started off my adulthood and young adulthood and even into full-on adulthood not planning to parent. Mm-hmm. So I would say, one of the adjustments for me was simply just learning how to be less selfish. I mean, that's the way I talk about it. People say, oh, it's not about being selfish, but figuring out how to balance my own needs with the needs of my relationship, with the needs of my child, with the needs of my career. So those are sort of global parenting challenges. I think for us, the added complexity of foster care, which confuses a lot of people, the uncertainty. And then I do think there is an, for us, we talk a lot about kind of having a kid who is already coming in with some, you know, she's, there are a lot of circles or boxes into which she's not going to fit. So she is a kid adopted out of foster care with two moms. There's lots of things that will mark her as different. And so even living in this bubble, I think our care and concern about her kind of well-being and safety and social functioning, not social functioning, but sort of how she's treated in the social situations is a particular challenge.
Right. And isn't it something that even at such a young age, you're already thinking about challenges that transcend childhood? Absolutely. I'm already thinking about outside, when you leave our little nest here, how are you going to handle the world?
Right. And in fact, with adoption, there's all the data points to starting those, some of those conversations at the minute that a kid arrives. And so we've been having conversations that she hasn't necessarily understood since she was a baby. And all of it really is to prep her for when she's a teenager, when she's a young adult, when she kind of starts to try to deal with these things on her own.
Right. So it's not such a shock to her system. She's already familiar with these terms and these instances and how to handle things. Right. So have you had any issues in a public setting as a queer person or particularly as a queer parent?
So I would say the answer differs. So what I experienced before being a parent, so in my young adulthood and just as I was coming out and again, talking about early to mid 90s, was a fair amount of explicit homophobia and some really nasty stuff. And that hasn't been the case for me. I've been, again, very privileged to live in places where it's been much more nuanced and less explicit and less threatening. But we've had a few instances with our kid that have been awkward would be the most generous and very uncomfortable at times. So we get asked if we're sisters, or people really trip over themselves by saying, who's the mom? And then if we say, I mean, it's also, it's complicated. Like we'll say we're both her parents, or if we were before she was adopted, you know, it just, so we would have our answer and then people just stumble and they don't know what to do. And luckily she has not noticed any of that yet. And she is currently in a really amazing phase of kind of sorting through what it means. Because as much as we live in this nice little bubble, she doesn't have a lot of other people around her who have same gender parents. And so she is doing a lot of psychological work around that. So she is telling everyone that she has two moms. And kind of announcing that. So she is gleefully oblivious to these things. But we have had a handful of situations or people just don't know what to do with us.
So when those type of situations happen, I mean, how do you reconcile such instances mentally?
You know, because there's so much, I am stronger and so much more kind of, my reserves are so much greater than they were when I was a young adult. There is a piece of me that's like, oh, I'm really grateful that I'm not dealing with blatant, currently in my life at this moment, blatant homophobia and things that make me feel unsafe. But I do worry as my child gets older and starts to pay attention. You know, again, it's back to that. I'm fine. Like I can handle it. I've now spent a long time in this body and this identity. But it is what to do when she realizes that someone's doing that or that. And part of what we've done with her is just sort of talk through all of these different things as she's clearly trying to work out what does it mean that she's different from these other kids. But I think and I think we'll probably talk about this a little bit more, but thinking about what my response will be to her, because I don't care what my, I mean, I can easily give a response to a stranger in a restaurant that makes me feel good, but I'm not really concerned right. about that person. I'm concerned about my own kid.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so you had mentioned that you, one of the points to foster parenting is to discuss things right away so that the child is more prepared for those type of questions as they age. So you've touched upon this a little bit, but how exactly are you preparing? You know, like what are some of the things that you're discussing specifically to your child about the world around us? And I mean, as we're seeing even now that hostilities that we think may be going away can shift depending yeah. on political climate, you know, and in an instant. So how, you know, what are some of the things that you say to her to let her know, even at just 4 years of age?
Sure. And again, I think this will shift probably even radically over the next year.
Right.
And I just want to acknowledge I am in a privileged place that I can even choose how to address this.
Right.
So we've done a couple of things, and one has nothing to do with addressing kind of hostility, but is just to constantly talk about different kinds of families. And though we certainly have books that talk about that, we actually find that it's much more useful to do it in our own way. And she's in this really funny place where she is counting the dog as part of the family. That's not that funny, but she is counting up that we are a family of four, like a nuclear right. family of four. And she keeps saying, and we're all girls. Me and Mama and Mama and Maslow, and we are four girls.
That is awesome.
So like this morning, she got up and she did that, and we said, yeah, what other families do we know, and what do they have? I have a brother who's gay and is partnered and has no kids, and I have a brother who's straight and has mm-hmm. kids and but isn't married. And so we are talking constantly about what families look like, and part of that came from the queer piece, but honestly, a lot of that came from the adoption and foster care piece. So we do a lot of discussing family composition and how that changes. And so that's one piece that is certainly not going to help her confront hostility, but at least normalizes the many, many different ways that people make a family. So not just family composition, but how kids come to be in particular situations. And then we talk a lot about, I'm sure you can relate to this, we talk a lot about kindness, and really, yes. honestly, even with adults right now, we just ordered the yard sign, and I'm not going to get it all right, but it basically says, in this house, we believe Black Lives Matter, you know, women are people.
Oh, yes.
And at the end, it says kindness matters most.
Right.
And I know that can seem sort of Pollyanna-ish and naive, but honestly, that's the most important thing that I want my kid to know, but also so to know that it's important to be kind, but that people have trouble being kind. And so she comes home and talks mm-hmm. about there's some kids in her class who aren't always nice to her. And she'll say, so-and-so had a trouble listening today, or he had trouble being kind. We've even brought it down to right. bugs, because she's starting to get afraid of bugs. And so we've talked about kind bugs and not kind bugs. So this right, is a right. long kind of winding response, but I haven't felt comfortable saying like, hey kid, people might be really, really mean to you because you've right. been adopted, or because you have two moms, or, you know, because your life, but I have instilled in her sort of, no matter what the sort of idea, and I know this is controversial, but that even when people have a hard time being kind to us, it's important for us to be kind to them. Now, I wouldn't take that up to every level of society, but in her,
right.
you know, 3¾-year-old brain, I feel like that's,
right.
that's an appropriate.
Yeah, that's something. Yeah, we've discussed similar things with my oldest daughter, particularly. She just finished up kindergarten and is heading into first grade. And I didn't send her to preschool or anything, so I kept her at home for a long time with me, because I can instruct from home. And so she was with me, and we instilled kindness a lot. And then we also instilled the whole idea of, particularly at her age, like you said, I would not necessarily place this on older, you know, as she gets older and she can see how politics and different aspects of society work, necessarily to be completely empathetic to people, but to question, you know, if someone's not being kind today, why might that be?
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's let's think about, do you think maybe they had a rough morning, or maybe they didn't eat their breakfast, you know, something like simple things that a kindergartner can relate to. And then I'm hoping anyway, and of course, like you, we can discuss this as she ages, but that she can start to see as she gets older that there are more complex reasons why someone may not be so kind.
Right.
So you can understand it, even if you don't agree with it. You know.
And the part for me that I think is the hardest is going to be to explain why somebody likes you, why somebody dislikes you, or is unpleasant or hateful or violent simply because of your identity. And I know, again, I have the privilege to not have had this, have to have had this discussion. I know lots of people of color who don't have that privilege and have had that conversations with their 3-year-olds because they have to for a matter of survival. We can get away with it for a little longer, but I'm not fully prepared to know how to do that.
Right. Yeah. You know, you're going to like questions of that. And one of the biggest questions that my daughter had is a girl that she considers one of her best friends, which we had to discuss that best friend does not mean a single friend, but rather can be a tier of friends. One of her best friends, and why she's lying to her about things. You know, I don't understand why she would lie about this. And really, it's not a harsh lie or something. She's just telling her that she's famous or, you know, whatever, just these outlandish stories. And my daughter's like, well, why would she lie about something like that? I don't understand why you would lie. And to have that discussion of, I mean, it's something small, but I'm like, well, I mean, at this age, I'm not sure that she's meaning it maliciously. You know, she's just hopeful, I guess. But something that we don't do here, and something that I never thought I would have to actually discuss at this age either. Why do people lie?
Right.
Well, that's an excellent question. Let's unpack that for a moment. But yeah, so you've already put steps in motion to help your daughter be prepared as she ages. But do you have any steps in mind that you would like to do differently for your daughter than what was done for you? As far as being just prepared for society in general, I mean, because as a child, you probably didn't have, I mean, maybe you did. Did you have discussions of different types of nuclear families?
So I my parents did a really nice job of it. So I think I come by my tendencies somewhat naturally. So my parents were, my dad's a psychologist and my mom worked in sort of related fields. And we had the kind of household where anyone was welcome. So my parents actually were foster parents before I was born. They weren't foster mm-hmm. parents when their bio kids were in the house, but they had been foster parents. And then we sort of had we had a model of family of choice way before a lot of other people did. So in the 70s and 80s, having this model that sometimes family of origin is not mm-hmm. everything or the only thing. And my parents had come from pretty dysfunctional at best families of origin. Mm-hmm. So I actually got this incredible model of how we choose people we want to spend our lives with. And sometimes they're related by blood and sometimes they're not. And I think my parents were fiercely devoted to social justice causes. So I got a lot of modeling around advocating for yourself, advocating for other people. So there's actually not mm-hmm. much I would necessarily do differently in that area. I will say, mm-hmm. and I think they would acknowledge this, my brother who came out is younger than me, and he came out when he was 13 and living in a mm-hmm. very conservative place and not again, this is at that point early to mid 90s, and mm-hmm. didn't really have good models, and my parents weren't ready to talk about sexuality with a 13-year-old at all,
mm-hmm.
let alone talk about him being gay. So I think the thing I would add to sort of my my discussion is talking about possible outcomes and possible iterations, and some of that we're doing by just sort of modeling Sorry. The one thing my parents, I'm jumping around a little bit. The one thing I was taught growing up was to ignore people who were being nasty or mean. Mm-hmm. And while I think that was a very pacifist response, I actually don't think it's probably the way that I would go about talking to my kid now. Again, I wouldn't promote retaliation, and I still still talk about how hitting is never the answer. I know people don't always agree with that in the world of in the social justice world, but I think I would. And again, I think my parents did it from a place of peace and also taught us how to advocate. But I think I ended up in some situations where I wish someone had taught me how to respond and how to confront, not aggressively and not in a dangerous way. And so I think I'm not sure how that will work, but I'd like to add that piece of it, sort of like, it's not, you don't have to just sit there and take it. It's not okay for people to be hateful and vitriolic. And it's important to figure out when it's safe and okay and important and necessary to stand up and say something.
Right. Absolutely. That's one thing we also foster with our daughter is, we don't tolerate bullying.
Mm-hmm.
And we have emphasized with her, if you see someone being bullied, the first thing we wish her to do, now whether she does it or not, is going to be obviously of her own volition at the time if we're not there. Say something. So one, the person being bullied doesn't feel alone.
Right.
Say something to the bully and then go get an adult. I don't want you running right into the middle of a fight or anything, but say something so the person being bullied does not feel alone. But you're right, it is difficult to kind of balance that. I mean, at what point do you step in or not step in? I know my daughter well enough to know that she would, despite saying just say something and then go get an adult, I fear that she may get herself in a physical situation someday to stop someone.
Right.
And that it's a huge fear, but we need people to do that. I just don't know how I feel about it being my daughter when her safety is on the line.
Yeah. And you know what? As a kid, I would have had no problem stepping in when someone else was being bullied, but I was mm-hmm. pretty badly bullied and I didn't know what to do for myself. So, and some of that is tied up in being a pre-adolescent and self-concept, but nobody else stepped up for me. So what I internalized from my growing up was you just ignore and it will stop, and it didn't. And certainly I wasn't going to respond. So I still haven't, I can really coach my kid and any young person around what to do if it's someone else. I have a hard time from my own experience being able to, I can do it with someone who I'm not related to. I can talk through that, but I'm still figuring out what it is that I would say to my daughter if she gets targeted and nobody else is standing up.
Right. So what advice would you suggest for any parent really that would help them foster a supportive environment for a child who might be questioning their sexuality or like your brother, you said he came out at 13. Mm-hmm. What would you say to a parent who maybe, they just want to know that their child is loved regardless of sexuality? What would you suggest that they do to help foster that environment?
So I think, I think sometimes my advice isn't heard by the people who would need to hear it. I think that, mm-hmm. I think the number one thing is to normalize different sexualities and gender identities and orientations throughout your child's life. That's the first thing you can do. But not everybody is comfortable doing that. So I think, making sure kids are exposed to different kinds of people would be the best approach in the beginning. But there are a couple of things. One, I think it's totally fine to say to your kid, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. I don't know how to handle this, but I love you. But the I love you has to be in there. If it really is someone who wants their kid to just know. And the other piece, and this is where my professional self also comes in. I'm a psychologist and a therapist by training, is admit when you need help. And I don't just mean go to therapy, but like there are, especially in this day and age, such phenomenal support resources for parents, mm-hmm. for kids, for, you know, parents of trans kids, parents of queer kids. Just if you don't know what to do or say, there are so many resources, and just find some help that feels consistent with your, you know, your beliefs, your values, your sort of your being. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we know so much about social isolation and rejection by family of origin, that to just make sure your kid knows he or she or they are not alone. And that sounds so very sort of cliche, but I think it's critical.
Oh, I agree. So you mentioned that you're in psychology. So what is your role within academia, and how long have you been in that role?
So I'm currently in a purely academic position. So I'm a tenure track mm-hmm. faculty member in a psychology department teaching undergrads at my institution, though I do work occasionally with graduate students at other places. So I'm a clinician by training, but I'm not doing clinical work now. I'm teaching and doing research exclusively. And I just mm-hmm. finished my fifth year on the tenure track.
Awesome. Congratulations.
Thanks. My tenure file goes in 2 months. So I'm at an interesting point.
Oh man. Yeah. So when did the roles of being a parent and an academic intersect exactly? You said this is 5 years. So you had just started your tenure track then.
Yes. So we became foster parents 2 weeks before my first year on the tenure track ended. And we had some placements mm-hmm. that summer. And then my daughter was placed 2 weeks before my second year on the tenure track started. And 2 weeks mm-hmm. before my wife started a position, her first year in a position at the same college. So it was
hectic.
Completely. Yes, that's an understatement.
Wow, that's amazing. How did you balance being, you know, just in your tenure track and your wife coming into that with having a small child? I mean, there's a million doctor's appointments and any illnesses. Yeah. How does that work out?
I mean, I honestly, like, it is a bit of a blur. Mm-hmm. And we were in a tricky situation because I technically had been there for a year, but there's no way I could take FMLA. So it would have been potentially allowed, although it was unclear because it was not an adoption, it was a foster placement. But I think I would have qualified. But you can't say 2 years before you start your second year in an academic position.
Right.
Oh, just kidding. And my wife was just starting, so she didn't qualify. So we had no choice. We could not take any leave. So in terms of what we did the best we could, and we called in again, very, very luckily, we each called in our mother for a bit of time because she came to us when she was 2 weeks old. She couldn't even start childcare until she was 7 or 8 weeks old, which again, most people don't put their kids in at that age. We did not have a choice. So we made some choices like that.
Yeah.
And again, this was a foster care situation and was very much intended to be foster care. So we had expected that she would be returning to her biological family. So all that to say, we lived on very little sleep, and we again, because we had lived here so little time, we didn't have a very strong social network. So we relied on family from out of town to help us some. Certainly wasn't my most productive year in terms of scholarship and research, but luckily because I was just in my second year, I could focus on my teaching. And I was not teaching any brand new classes. And I had to learn, which was the hardest and continues to be the hardest lesson, to kind of let go of my own very high expectations, or at least reduce them, and just recognize, like, we are human beings and there's only so much we can do.
Yeah, that was probably the most difficult thing, and still something I struggle with a little bit, but most certainly when I had my daughter, I was in the middle of my, well, not quite in the middle, but a year or so into my master's track. And having her and realizing I can no longer take the number of classes that I'm used to taking, because I simply don't have the time to get stuff done.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a moment where you're not really questioning who you are, but you do feel a little lost.
Yeah. Yeah. I said to someone recently that I was working this summer on balancing, on work-life balance. And she said, well, at least now you're trying, because I had a reputation in graduate school of not doing that. I just worked all the time, and I still work a lot. She was teasing me, but it actually occurs to me now that life is more important than work, which might sound self-evident to everyone else, but it was not where I was. And then I get a lot of messages that that's not accurate. So that's what I truly believe. But academia does not reinforce that message.
Correct.
So yeah. Then I come into that, but particularly the summer when I'm prepping a tenure file. But I also have a kid who's at this incredibly fun age and very active, and we want to do things, and our family's all far away. It's like, no, I'm actually trying to figure out how to go to the office and then do things at the office and then leave it behind and be with my family.
Right. So then would you say that was that's the greatest struggle that you've encountered so far of being a parent and an academic, is just figuring out the work-life balance?
Absolutely. Figuring out the work-life balance, which is both figuring out how to spend enough time with my kid, but also figuring out how to have a marriage and a relationship that gets tended to. And I think the layer that gets thrown on top of that for everyone is either messages from greater society or messages from the academy about what that balance should look like. And then I do think there's something about being, both of us being academics and both of us being parents and both of us being women, that complicates it, not in our own dynamic or our own relationship, but in other people's perspectives and kind of beliefs about what we should or should not be doing.
Right. Yeah. Everybody has an opinion of
how
you should be dividing your time, or where you should be, or if you should even be there.
Right.
And
I will say people didn't know what to do with us in a variety of ways. Partly the foster care thing, people who had no kids, or people who had their own biological kids, and maybe even people who had adopted in a different way, didn't know what to do with us. Mm-hmm. And we're pretty clumsy. So I had people say to me when I came back that August and we had this baby, what were you thinking? And someone insinuating or saying that perhaps we shouldn't have had a baby placed with us when we were going back to two academic positions.
A
lot of, there were some people certainly who were supportive, but there was a lot of shock and I'm sure projections of their own stuff. But for us, it was really hard to be like, okay, we're going to make this happen no matter what the end result is. And we were doing the sleepless parenting without knowing if the kid was going to be here, if she was going to be here
right.
a week, a month, a year. So to have people sort of question our motive, our kind of stability was one of the hardest parts in that early time.
Right. Can you, since you've experienced this, can you think back and think of any ways that that struggle could be lessened a little bit as a parent, just in academia, or perhaps maybe you see a way that if a new faculty member came in to the fray here and was going through similar struggles, what would you do to try to help lessen the rough times of, first of all, early childhood being a parent, but in general, make them feel more welcome? Or it's tough to really lend a hand, I suppose, at this point in time, when your child is still little too, but you know, anything that you would have welcomed yourself.
Yeah. I mean, and I think they would have been so small. So one of the things that ended up happening in my wife's department, a bit delayed, is that another faculty member was having a baby later in the year. And so they threw her a baby shower and they included my wife. And so they did a sort of a joint shower, and we never would have had a baby shower. That wasn't it, but it was a communication from this department that you matter and your family matters.
Right.
And so nothing like that would have needed, but I think had more people, and again, it was tricky. I was coming in, I was pretty new to the institution. I was new to the department. I didn't have a lot of close relationships, but I think, can I bring you a meal? Or, wow, right, that must be really overwhelming. You're doing a great job. Or, I really like, and,
yeah,
and for me, we have now actually helped to mentor through some other faculty member who have become foster parents. And so we can actually say, I don't know exactly what you're going through, but I've been in that situation, let's talk. And so I think we really love that we can be in that role now, because we had nobody who could, or who we knew of, who could play that role. So I think on the parenting level, just to say like, you must be exhausted, here's a cup of coffee, or not even a cup of coffee, you know, just right, some pure basic social support and reinforcement. And then I think the queer parent, the foster parent, the all of that stuff, I think if you are in an institution and you've been there for a while and you know that there might be someone else who could be helpful or who could provide some common ground, then to facilitate that social connection.
Right.
Because
right,
that's really important to people.
Absolutely. I think it's extremely important. I mean, people ask you, why are you there? The fact that you were there provides representation on a number of levels, which just by itself, I would think, has to provide some sort of comfort for anybody coming in, even before you step up and say, hey, do you need a cup of coffee or glass of wine or
right,
you know, whatever it may be. Just your presence alone is helpful.
Yes. And, you know, in the foster parent world, one of the things that happens is people tend to, the flip side of the sort of questioning or confusion or ignoring is to portray foster parents as saints. And I never want that. So I never wanted, we have a lot of people right, who say, oh, I could never do that. I mean, that's not what I want. But it wasn't even the foster parent piece of it. It was just, yeah, like, because most of the people I work with in academia, whether they're straight or not, you know, whatever their gender identity, many of them have kids. And so, and they are associate professors and full professors. And so they've done some version of this. So even to say, hey, I've done some version of that, and that's hard, here's my
right,
number one tip.
Right. Yeah. That's awesome. Have you felt welcome in academia since you started, even as, or have you seen any, how can I phrase this? Any differences as a student between being a woman, a queer woman, and then as a parent? Of course, you were a professional by the time you were a parent, but have you always felt welcome in academia?
No. Well, it is certainly, it's certainly varied. Well, let's see, as a woman and as a queer person, my graduate experience, so I had to think about this a little bit before the interview, because my graduate program, I think, has done a lot of work since I arrived there and left there. Mm-hmm. And I think the mm-hmm. institution as a whole has done a massive amount of work. But at the time when I was in my graduate program, there was very little. There were certainly powerful women academics, although they very much had to play by, sorry, it's an antiquated office.
Oh, you're fine.
They very much had to play by the kind of old boys rules. But there was very little LGBTQ representation in the faculty and very little attention paid. So my program, my background's in counseling psychology, and counseling psychology has a very strong social justice orientation, but how that plays out depends on the program. So my program was very focused on racial justice and diversity, cultural diversity, but did not have great discussions and track record around LGBTQ issues. And then there was some complexity around religious faith and values and kind of the student demographics. And so there was sometimes a tension between, I think, subgroups of students. So that was kind of being a student, being a woman, being openly, being out, and being a not feminine, not quiet person on top of that. I felt often like I was perceived as bossy or bitchy or abrasive or all those things that you're not supposed to be.
Right.
And though I ended up feeling good about my program, there were some struggles along the way in terms of students and faculty. And then I think that the extra layer for me, so I was doing clinical training and clinical work and seeing clients, and I often had more expertise about particularly trans issues than my supervisors. So that wasn't a case of feeling unwelcome, but feeling really uncomfortable with the dynamic where I was really having to teach some of the faculty about issues that it's fine. I didn't go back to graduate school until I was in my early 30s. I did a lot of things between undergrad and graduate school, but it wasn't a great feeling that I was having to teach people who had been in the field. So that was my graduate school experience by and large. It is interesting to think about it as a professional and a parent. Because those things coincide, I think because I almost immediately after being on the tenure track became a parent, I have felt a tension between wanting to be acknowledged as someone who has responsibilities outside of work and has schedule constraints, and also recognizing that I don't want people who are childless to be punished for being childless.
Right.
So I don't want, just because I have a kid, for someone who doesn't have a kid to have to do all the extra work, and that's not it. But I also do want to feel like my daycare pickup schedule is considered when we're making schedules and scheduling meetings and things like that. So I don't know if that's a clear answer.
Well, I mean, you mentioned that the program, you felt overall, like as an undergraduate, you felt happy with the program, but I'm interested in when you said that you had to teach your professors about trans issues. When that was coming up, were they open and welcome to your teaching of them, or was it kind of a little bit abrasive situation?
Yeah. And just to clarify, it was my graduate program, not undergrad.
Oh, your graduate program. Oh, yep. Sorry.
That's okay. So there was an uncomfortable openness. And I had one faculty member and supervisor who I ended up working with very closely, who was pretty phenomenal. But the way it worked early in our training is we were assigned a faculty member. So I would say there was a bit of defensiveness, because of course these are licensed psychologists with a lot of experience, but they were at least willing to hear what I had to say. What I really wanted was for them to go do their own work, so to
go
education training, and even on just the sort of not trans issues, like even on just sort of sexual orientation. There was my overall feeling was there was a general discomfort in that way that I had not experienced for a long time. And it certainly wasn't true of the whole university. So there was no outward, there was some, I would say, implicit bias and some subtle homonegativity. There wasn't a lot of outward homophobia. There were definitely people, students and faculty, who I think struggled with reconciling their own personal values with working with queer clients or trans clients. It certainly wasn't the most open environment or the most kind of eager to learn, but it wasn't totally closed off.
Right. Have you noticed a shift in that from, I guess, the type of openness and how the LGBT community has been treated based on, I mean, you touched upon this a little bit earlier in the interview, geographical factors playing a role, or the institution, you know, whatever state you were in, or just the public community, how things shift based on where you live. And you were also speaking of, you know, coming out in the 90s. Can you have a discussion a little bit about time as well? How things have shifted?
Yeah. So in terms of geography, so my graduate schooling was in Virginia. And though that, you know, I graduated 5 years ago, but I started in the mid 2000s. I would say that area in Virginia, even in the last 10 years, has really shifted and changed, and the public community has shifted and changed, and Virginia as a state has made some progress. And that particular university has really done amazing things. So I would bet my graduate program today feels very different. So coming out in the 90s, like I said, I was at a women's college in the Northeast, and it was kind of Mecca for lesbians, at
right,
least.
Right.
And that was not an issue. But when I returned home for summers and for vacations and time off, I was living in Virginia in a very sort of homogeneous suburban community. And I remember a girlfriend coming home with me from college and her grabbing my hand in the shopping mall, and my having this total internal freak out and just being like, that's not okay.
Right,
because
right.
It wasn't, it was the early to mid 1990s. It was not okay. And then I moved to New York City and I lived in San Francisco, and then, you know, it was sort of the heyday, and everything was, not everything, but it was mostly fine. And then I moved back to Virginia for a very long time. And in the time that I lived there, it did shift, I think. So my graduate program was not particularly progressive when I was there, but I was finding that the community that I had built and the larger community was much more progressive and open. So watching Virginia for the last 25 years or so has been pretty interesting. And then, like I said, we lived in Portland, Oregon, which has its own set of problems, but in terms of being LGBTQ friendly was great. And then we moved to Ithaca, which again, not a totally unproblematic community in other ways, but both the campus where I am and the community are quite progressive and feel very comfortable.
Right. So have you noticed similar differences or shifts as far as being a woman? Or now that you're a parent, I mean, you might probably didn't notice it so much before becoming a parent, but have you seen similar differences or trends depending on where you have lived or the institutions of which you've been a part?
Yeah, well, I guess the thing that is interesting, before I was a parent, so as I was I did a master's degree and then worked for a few years and then went back and did my master's and PhD. And so from the time I sort of engaged with academia and graduate school in any way, I always worked for people who were parents, and I often worked for women who had sort of remarkable scholarly careers and were parents. And so I think I was keenly aware of what that meant. But I got a warped message, right? So I had these women that I worked for who were strong and powerful and brilliant and accomplished, and somehow managed to see their kids and take their kids to soccer games, but they were traveling all the time and working all the time. And I still don't understand how they did that.
Right.
And now that I am an academic and a parent, I don't know how they do it. I think I now have slightly more realistic perspective, because I do work with other parents and I work with parents of older kids, and I see where people put the emphasis. I wouldn't say my institution is parent unfriendly at all. I think it's fairly parent friendly as much as the academy can be. They're still always going to be. I think for us, the problem is with two academic schedules. In some ways we have the benefit of flexibility, but in other ways, like, we have to hire babysitters if we both have a work event in the evening, and there's no acknowledgement of things like that. haven't noticed much in terms of geography. I guess my undergraduate institution, I was completely clueless about anyone's parental status and how they were treated. And I would love to hear in retrospect what those people had to say about that institution. I know there was it was a women's college, but the vast majority of tenured faculty were men. And so while I was there again in the 90s, there was a lot of discussion about disparities. But beyond that, I wasn't very aware. I do think in general, disparities are being attended to more, and sort of academics are organizing and trying to push for more family-friendly, parent-friendly policies. So I do think there's been a shift over time for that.
Right. So would it be safe to say that you feel that the support level is increasing, but we're still not quite at a comfortable level yet of support?
Absolutely.
Okay. I agree. So what do you personally feel needs to change within academia to give more support for anyone really within the LGBT community or women or parents or any type of intersectionality that may occur between those categories?
I mean, some of it, because this is the way I think, you know, some of it is our structural changes that are never going to happen. So I think it's funny because I just as a brief aside, you know, I've listened to a number of previous episodes and it's always like, oh, this is going to be so depressing, so depressing. I actually felt like a lot of what I have to say is less depressing than I would have predicted 10 years ago. But this is the point in which some of that stuff gets in the way. I just think the model that we have of tenure and the expectations and sort of you either teach really well or you do research really well. And if you do research really well, you've got to go get this external funding, I don't think is a human friendly or family friendly approach. And, you know, we can argue about the merits of it and the necessity of it. So I think short of overhauling that system, right, there's lots that individual institutions and individual departments can do. So, you know, this is a little bit different, but I talk with my campus has had a lot of discussions in the last couple of years around race and culture and ethnicity. And my students say, yeah, we can talk about all you want, but until there's representation, it doesn't matter. I need to see faculty of color teaching me.
Right.
And on this campus, there are plenty of faculty who I think identify within the LGBT spectrum, and there are plenty of women, but I don't know that we necessarily provide support for those people when they come and connect them with other people. So students can see, oh, I've had a bunch of gay or queer or whatever professors, but making sure that new faculty don't just go through new faculty orientation where they learn the policies and procedures and how to report an emergency, but get some real mentoring for women, for parents, for queer people, for faculty of color, for first generation college students who come into academia. You know, that's a particular thing where I have colleagues who it's assumed that everyone in their family had a graduate degree, when in fact they're the first person who's made it through undergrad, let alone a graduate program. And there's all sorts of stuff around being in the academy that can, you know, we talk a lot about imposter syndrome, and that can be generated and fostered by lots of different things. So, you know, I think there are policies that people can set up and in terms of how to schedule classes and what to expect of faculty. And there's certainly policies around parental and family leave. Again, I'm not sure it would have helped us in our situation, but some acknowledgement that people become parents and families in different ways, and how can we support that, and how can we allow flexibility, but also just providing institutional support, infrastructure, and a lot of that is not about dollars, right? Mentoring, unfortunately, we then ask people to provide more, particularly women from you know, underrepresented groups to do more emotional labor. by asking them to mentor a new faculty, but if we could perhaps offer, you know, compensation or course release or some sort of other way to get people to provide that mentoring without just assuming they'll do it because they're wanting to help people. I think that that could go a long way.
What would you say? I mean, as you're not a student any longer, but having experienced it, obviously, and now having students, do you think the level of support for the LGBT community is, I mean, it's obviously getting better. You've said that, and it's changed since you were a student. But where would you rate the current level of support? I mean, there's representation, or should there be more representation? I mean, how is that community responding right now?
So I'm in an unusual place as in my current institution. So we regularly get named like on the top 10 list of campuses for LGBT students. Although I would say the LGB probably a lot easier than the T. But my, you know, my graduate institution, which I think has grown significantly, you know, there's still clearly institutions around the country that are not at that point. And one of the cool things that happened in my professional organization and that I got involved with in graduate school when I didn't have community right where I was. So the American Psychological Association has a great graduate student organization. And we did a lot of outreach to LGBT students across the country, particularly those who are at institutions where they didn't feel supported. So we had opportunities to network with other students. We had opportunities to get a mentor. So someone at another institution who identified as somewhere on the LGBT spectrum who could mentor you through graduate school. We connected graduate students with other graduate students at other institutions. I was accepted to go to this really cool, fully funded week-long institute on LGBT psychology. And for me, I think it was after my second year of graduate school where I felt pretty isolated, and I just went to be with 25 graduate students and 25 scholars. And we called it gay camp for the week, like providing those kinds of opportunities. So if you can't infuse the institution with it, making sure that people know through their professional organizations, through their academic societies, where to get that support. And then also if you're at an institution that is better than your department, making sure you know where the institutional support is, where the support groups, where the whatever local resources are available.
Right. How did you find out about that camp? Was that something that, you know, you had to search out on your own, or?
I must have gotten it through. So I was already involved with this graduate student organization, but not that committee. And it was a call for proposals, and it was a competitive process, but I found out about it through the American Psychological Association, but I must have been on a listserv or a mailing. So I guess that's the other thing. If you're not already connected into that, hopefully departments or programs can, I at least felt like I got mentoring around that, not about the LGBT stuff, but around my professional society and how to connect.
Right.
And again, not all disciplines are psychology or social work, or not all disciplines lend themselves to that. So then sometimes I think people have to go be a little more creative.
Right. So you've mentioned some things that you were a part of. Are you an activist in any way?
So this is where my own self-criticism will come out. I used to identify very strongly as an activist, and lately I've been feeling more like a slacktivist. But here's what I'll say. I don't go out. I am too old and too tired to go out and do as many kind of in the street things that I used to do. So I used to show up at every March on Washington and every protest I could get to and every pride and every, you know, and lots and lots and lots of things. And I don't do as much of that. And I don't want to take credit for things that I'm not doing, but I feel like I am passionate about social justice, and I'm passionate about particularly those things that touch my own experience. And so I do a lot of work in my community and in my teaching around adoption, around foster care, around ability and disability status around a number of different issues. And I feel like the last couple of years have sort of increased the urgency. So I'm doing small acts and doing things on my own, and certainly that social justice orientation infuses my parenting. And I'm trying to figure out what I can do in a concrete way that returns to some of those roots, because I think it's desperately needed right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So if someone came to you and they said that they wanted to be an activist, with your experience, having gone out and into the streets, as you said, and in marching in pride parades and such, how would you encourage them? Like, where would you direct them to find information or to connect, to know where certain demonstrations are happening, just how to get the information?
It's an interesting question, because nobody has ever come to me before they've started the work. People have come to me after mm-hmm. the fact. So I guess there are a couple of things. One thing that you didn't mention, but that I would say to anyone who was coming to me talking about activism, is that that's great. Have your plan, but make a plan for self-care. Because particularly in a hostile, broken environment, you've got to figure out a way to take care of yourself no matter what it is that you're doing. So that's one piece of it. And then I think social connection and social facilitation is everything. So probably what I would do is say, okay, on what topic and what area are you feeling most strongly pulled, and what's your passion? And then I would use my own connections to sort of put them in touch with other people. But I think social media is a mixed blessing. But yeah. There's so many resources for people who want to connect. So here, in Ithaca, there are people organizing around particular issues, and other issues are not really a focus. And so I would say, okay, do you want to be involved in person? Let's think about where else in this region, which has a lot of rural land, you know, where else can I connect you with people in this region? Or do you need to do this work via the internet? How can we get you connected there? And I feel lucky, again, that I know a lot of people and a lot of places doing a bunch of these different, you know, doing this work, and I have enough people to connect them to. Mm-hmm. And I think if someone were even before that, I would, like, before that point, just like, oh, I want to do something, I need to feel active, I would again yeah. ask, you know, about what issue are you passionate, and here's some things that you can get reading about what's happening around this issue, and then come back and talk to me.
Right. So another question, what do you consider an ally? That word gets thrown around a lot. What is an ally to you?
That's a tricky one. I mean, I have such mm-hmm. I still think of such an old definition of that. And I think the kind of ally I need now is so different than the kind of ally I needed when I was 17 or 18. Honestly, like, if I think about my life now, the kinds of allies I would need would be back to that sort of stuff I talked about when I became a parent in this way that people didn't understand. So it's not necessarily even an ally just around queer stuff, but like someone to say and stand up in a faculty meeting, like, hey, this is what's going on with Jesse, and this is this thing, and we should acknowledge this. You know, I have plenty of straight allies in my life who stand up for queer stuff and put pride ribbons around their Facebook photos, and that's good. Like, right, that's good stuff. I'm not trying to, mm-hmm. Minimize that, but I think there is something within academia about, if you are coming from a place of, and I hope I would do this with other situations, if you are coming from a place of privilege or power or mm-hmm. status, so if you have tenure, mm-hmm. stand up yeah. for people who do not have tenure, whether it's around them being trans or around them being from a different, you know, racial background, or around poverty, class stuff.
Right.
That it's fine to say in someone's office, oh, I support you, but it should be visible to other faculty, to administrators, and to students.
That makes sense. I've heard a lot of tenure track faculty at the university that I work at discuss about adjuncts needing more support.
Yes, and that's something I am embarrassed to say I just neglected in this whole conversation, but on my campus in particular, there has been organizing around contingent faculty. It is so easy to be completely wrapped up in my own experience on the tenure track and feel like I am not afforded advantages, but absolutely when I look at contingent faculty and people, and certainly I adjuncted throughout my graduate school experience. I don't have tenure, so I don't have long-term job stability, but I know that my contract generally will be renewed. I know I have benefits. I know I have a salary that is a living wage. So that would be an example of a place where I feel like I have some, I certainly have relative power and privilege, although pre-tenure, it's hard to figure out. But yeah, that making sure that everybody sort of pays it forward for people who are, and I think this is a national crisis around the adjunctification of faculty, and it's going to take a lot of work to undo that.
Right. So are there any particular programs at, I mean, you'd best be able to describe, obviously, your university that you're currently working at, but are there programs that are providing, you feel like, the best support for students and perhaps maybe even some training for allies?
So I will admit that I'm not as up to date on the current programs. And again, this campus is sort of generally generally visibility of LGBT students and faculty and staff is pretty high. I know Safe Zone has been a very useful program across the country. It certainly has its critics, but in terms of making sure that you provide some sort of visible sign that you are an ally or a place to be, well, it still says, I think, a safe place. There's some debate about whether that makes sense as a term, but in some way signifying that you are a place where people can come talk about gender identity and sexual orientation and things like that. And there's some training around how to be an appropriate Safe Zone member. But I don't know much about the other formal programs. I do know that it's got to be more than having one, you know, annual speaker for first year students about being X or Z. If we can provide experiences that connect to academic experience, you know, provide experiences that connect the academic learning to their sort of social learning, and allow people places to think critically about differences and commonalities for all of these things. But it is amazing to me, the student body that I see here, and just how much it is a non-issue for them, particularly around, I mean, not all of it, right? But around being allies to LGB folks. Because these kids, these young adults, grew up, you know, with people being out in their high schools and their middle schools and their, not everyone, but it's just a different world.
Right. Which provides just hope for the future, right? That is going to continue to be less of an issue. Like, why are we even discussing this type of looks from students someday? Why do we even have to have this discussion anymore?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's a ways away, but it's a hope. So going to like a national or international level even, what do you think are the most important fights the LGBT movement is dealing with right now?
So I actually think it is, there are a couple of things, but I would say for me, it's actually what we're not dealing with particularly well that is concerning to me. You mentioned intersectionality earlier, and I know that gets thrown around as a buzzword, but I think what we need to focus on, we need to break out of a white cisgender middle class model, and I think that's happening in some places, but I think that for queer people and queer people of color and queer trans people or gender non-conforming people, and this is particularly on my mind We had a trans woman of color who was killed in our little bubble town last week. And there is wow. there's an epidemic of trans women of color being killed. And I think as a community, we have focused on things that are important to many members. And certainly I have benefited from a lot of those. And as a white cis woman, I have a lot of privilege, but we've got to focus on members of our community who are not feeling like they're part of our community or feeling included, and sort of put our money where our mouth is in terms of inclusivity. And I think the other thing is there's a lot of fear right now about rollback of legislation or new legislation being introduced that is scary. And though I think probably a lot of those bills aren't going to get very far, we need to acknowledge the real pain and fear that happens in North Carolina, that happens in Texas when these bills are even introduced, even if they never pass and go into law. So I do think there's lots of fighting and new fighting and refighting to do on that legislative front. But I guess for me, the most pressing issue really is this, you know, I want to feel part of a community that brings people in and recognizes the true diversity of that community and doesn't focus just on my needs.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of work to be done, right?
Yeah.
Well, that was, I didn't want to go the whole depressing route, that it seems that a lot of our episodes start out with, it is depressing, but I didn't want to end the episode on a depressing note, but it is still hopeful that, like you said, the community now, the students that you're seeing are seeing it as less of an issue.
Yeah. And actually I could end it on one slightly more positive note related to the same depressing issue. So my campus has a drag show every spring, and I've gone as often as I can. And this spring's show, they raise money at every drag show. And so this one particularly was for trans women of color. But the crowd, it was standing room only in our biggest campus space, which was, first of all, that was amazing. And the performers were far more diverse than they've been in the past. And they were very in your face about this sort of need for gay and queer people to pay attention to people of color, to pay attention to trans folks. So it was still, there was anger, there was righteous indignation, there was, you know, people were really stirred up, but the largely white audience rolled with it and applauded it. And there was really an amazing feeling in this room. And as one of the only faculty member there, I was really proud of those students. So I guess that's the flip side of this, is people recognizing that there's all this work to be done. And some of these young people who have everything to risk, everything to lose in this, really throwing themselves into the fight.
Yeah, that's hopeful. Very hopeful.
Yes.
Well, I would like to thank you very much again for taking the time to be interviewed.
You are very welcome. It was really nice to talk to you.
I would like to thank Jessie again for taking the time out of her day to speak with me. Thank you so much for sharing part of your life, and thank you so much for having this conversation with us and letting our listeners hear it. Please be sure to head over to our page so that you can see the show notes for this episode. In it, you're going to find a biography on Jessie, as well as a list of links that Jessie suggested that we share with you all. I hope you take the time to go over and check it out. So, on that note, thanks again for listening, and stay nasty.
Dear Nasties, thank you for listening to today's episode. You can find our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and basically anywhere one can listen to podcasts. Please rate and review us on iTunes, because that is how other people find us. And who doesn't need a bit more nasty in their lives? It's also a great possibility to support the podcast if you enjoy our content. If you enjoy our content, you can also like our Facebook page. On the Facebook page, you can also find links and info on the subjects that we discuss in our podcast, so check that out. You can also pop us a line on Facebook if you have criticism or praise. We like praise. Or just suggestions on what we should discuss or what we could do better, etc., etc. So if there's something you want to tell us, then please pop us a line on Facebook or write us an email, shewhopersistedpodcast@gmail.com. Via the Facebook page, you can also find a Facebook discussion group that is a great possibility for us to get in touch with the listeners, for our listeners to get in touch with us. Thank you again for listening, and stay nasty.